Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. Hi, I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Howdy, howdy, howdy. Hello. Welcome to our second episode. This is all going to be all about Kieran's story today, which I'm really looking forward to hearing. Kieran's been doing all of his homework and has some lots of notes in front of him. And
you know, it was, as I said to you just before we came on here, mate, like I, surprising the amount that I've kind of blocked out or don't seem to have any kind of memory of. And, you know, us talking about it, like this seems to be quite a common theme. Almost like a bit of post-traumatic stress, even though it's, you know, it's a strong term that, but it's really traumatic, like just reading through it. And I think, oh, I clearly don't remember that, or I thought that happened here or this happened then. And so, it's, you know, it's been a bit of a walk down memory road for me while I've been looking into this. So I can't wait to tell it. And I really hope some listeners get some benefit from it. So I'm sure they will.
Absolutely. That's without question. Just any men sharing their story is powerful. And so many people will get so much from this, whether it is those men that are going through it or their partners who want to know how to support them. But like we said, this is why we're doing this. So yeah, it's all good. Actually, I have the same thing. When I first started sharing my story, I did a timeline of what I, you know, what I could remember we went through. And by the time I then sat down with Jenna and she was going, well, what about this, what about that, my timeline was messy as hell because there was arrows going in. There was just so much stuff that I missed out, and it is that kind of trauma aspect of it, because you go tunnel vision sometimes. And but you know, this is what we're here for, is to deconstruct that and to help people just be a bit more clear in their journey through it, hopefully, and to know what to expect, what's coming. But
yeah, that's the aim, isn't it? So yeah, I can't wait to talk about it tonight. Not that I like talking about myself, but like it's the majority of it is like, you know, there's a spiel in my head that just comes out, but actually I've looked at it and gone, oh, there's a bit more than I thought. So anyway, mate, Before we talk about that, how are you doing? You all right?
Good. Yeah. It's half term, which brings its own challenges and delights and challenges. You know, it's great spending a bit of extra time with kids when they're not at preschool. But we mentioned just before we hit record, I mean, Evelyn just woke up today and it's just one of those days where she just chose rage from the outset and it never really changed all day. And it's been a hectic day, and like then put them to bed and she was being so sweet in bed, and it's like suddenly that, like kind of almost 20-minute switch to just being so nice and saying, and she's so cheeky as well, but it'd be like, right, it's time to go to bed. She'd be like, cuddle me, daddy. So give her a cuddle. And then she's like, no, cuddle in bed, because then she knows I'm not going to get in and it's a good chance I might fall asleep. And then she gets a nice long cuddle. But she's just, I love like the little, you know, she's 2.5 years old and just to know the little intricacies. Then she's like, little tickle. And then she likes being tickled on her hand, and then she just quickly flips up her elbow and wants to be tickled on her elbow. I'm like, there you go, night night. And she's like, no, other hand too.
I think that's called manipulation, mate. She's learning it already.
I'm 40 years old. I've been getting manipulated by women for a long time.
And one of them's 2.5.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like I get it with Enya. Like, you try and be the solid dad sometimes. Like, yeah, you put the boundaries in place. But I don't know, they just got this look and you're like, all right.
I'm not even fighting it. I know I am. She's got me wrapped around her little finger and I don't care. I love it. I went downstairs after that and said to Jenna, I was like, that today was hard. And she was like, wasn't it just? And then I said, but that, just that little bit at the end, just it makes me want to go and like wake her up and just start all over again. But it recharges your batteries, and perhaps they know what they're doing, like, you know, like you said, a bit of manipulation, but she knows then she's filling me with so much love to then go again tomorrow, no matter how what mood she wakes up in. But yeah, it's good. Took Ray to get a haircut, which he hates.
Oh, yeah.
And that was hard work. And so we're actually now at the stage where we're like, might just let him grow it out for a while. Because we don't want to put the poor lad through something he's hating. And
he'll do it when he's ready, you know. Like they all have their own phases, don't they?
Yeah.
You don't want it to be like a traumatic thing that he remembers.
No, exactly. Like put him in a straight jacket or something.
Scared of scissors for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, now we'll leave it. We've actually discussed whether we might even learn how to cut hair like this.
Yeah.
Like just because you do anything for them, you know, you don't want to put them in any kind of distress. No. But that'll certainly be the last haircut we get for a while. And see what happens. But yeah, good, mate. You?
Same thing, really, mate. It's a half term. And yes, your today was my yesterday. Enya was on one. She's a very strong-willed little lady, where Seb is like, you know, the Mr. Soft advert.
Yeah,
I remember like years ago, that's just a soft that walked along like just floppy. That's Sebby. Like he doesn't care about much. He, as long as he's fed, he's quite happy. Where Enya wants everything like perfect, and I want it now, so I need it now. So yesterday was a tough day, but today's been fine. We went swimming today. She had her first eye appointment, which was interesting. She suddenly became the most shy person in the world. I treated them to a McDonald's today, which I usually don't do. You know me, mate. I'm big on my health and things like that, but I'm trying to break the ice with a very frosty daughter sometimes. We had a little cheeky McDonald's, and then I've just been doing other bits and bobs. So nothing major, but it's just nice to have that time with them, that little bit of relaxed time. Because next week it all starts again, and back to the chaos for 6 weeks.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, on a little bit of trivia for you before we get into today's episode, I found this out recently. I can't reference it. I heard it on another podcast. So if it is wrong, then forgive me, everyone. But it still sounds interesting anyway. How many ingredients are in McDonald's fries?
Oh, you're going to scare me now. I don't know. 37?
You just blow me out of the water there. No, I mean, like most people would be like, okay, well, it is potato. That's one. And maybe salt and oil.
Yeah.
Okay, for it. 17.
17?
17.
Yeah, man, that's not good, is it? I saw something as well once, like they don't go moldy in things, and they only use a certain type of potato. Yeah, it's mad. Like if they're left on the side, they don't decompose like normal food because of what they're cooked in.
Wow.
But I'm pretty sure, like when this is going back to like the IVF type of stuff, Jim was told to eat like fatty things, like a McDonald's fries after the transfer.
Yeah,
I'm pretty
There's a big myth going around amongst the IVF community about women eating McDonald's fries after transfers.
Yeah, I just think that's because they want some McDonald's fries. Like, I don't know the research behind it, so I'm only joking. But I remember a big thing about it, like a really big thing. That, and I had to wear orange pants, like orange.
Nice.
Like Jen was like, "You've got to wear orange. It's good luck for fertility." And then I got into a discussion about how I don't believe in luck. And with a highly pumped up wife with hormones in her, I was going to lose that battle all day, mate. So I just wore the orange pants.
I got a funny story about pants, but we'll save that for another episode. This is yours.
Yeah. Sorry, mate. We might get a bit mistracked some points, won't we? It'd be humorous.
Yeah, definitely. But right. Well, on that note, we're 9 minutes in, so let's get it on, shall we? It's all about you today, Kieran. It's your story, your way to kind of introduce the pain, but the joy at the end of it. So I'm looking forward to hearing it.
So, like, my story starts. Me and Jen got married in 2011, in December, and we kind of. For a while, we hadn't been trying not to get pregnant because we knew we were getting married, but it hadn't worked. And we kind of anticipated Jen might need some help because she's got polycystic ovaries. So we were kind of expecting to, you know, she might need some Clomid or something along those lines just to kind of get her kind of into a regular cycle. So after we got married, we went to the doctors and said, look, we've been trying for a while. And they kind of did all the checks on Jen. And at that time, we had no, I had no concerns about me, and Jen had no concerns about me. And then in early 2012, just before they kind of gave her the prescription for Clomid, they were like, well, we need to just check your husband. It's a routine thing. We've got no concerns about it. And so I went and gave a semen sample in 2012. That in itself, it's an experience that we would discuss in a later episode. So I gave the sample, and then a couple of weeks later, we got called back into the consultation to see the consultant. And he sat down and he said, look, Jen, we can get you ovulating. That's fine. And he turned to me and he said, but there's not much we can do for you, Kieran. And I was like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean there's not much you can do for me? Like, I kind of brushed it off as like just a comment. And then at that point, he realized that I had no idea about my infertility. I didn't know about it. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, it was literally like us having this conversation and you telling me. Like, it was
my
that
word.
And then there was kind of a real kind of change of atmosphere in the room. I distinctly remember this. It felt like a complete out-of-body experience. Most people have been through a stage where you hear about someone you love has died or something's happened and you have that absolute moment of panic, that out-of-body experience. It happened to me then, and my heart was racing and I felt like I was watching the whole conversation from the side. That kind of quickly altered back to me being in the room and kind of conscious of what was going on. But I used to do a lot of like bodybuilding and like lifting because I played rugby. But I never took any like stimulating drugs or anything. But the doctor immediately asked me, have you ever taken steroids? And I said, no. And he asked me again. He's like, you can tell me if you have because it's very effective on your fertility. And I was like, no. Never taken any steroids. And it was almost like he was trying to immediately find a reason of why I might have not known, if that makes sense. So I kind of left that room in a bit of a daze and kind of, I can't really remember the rest of the conversation because Jen took over because she could see that I was just like, what the fuck? Well, that's how I felt. And then when I left, we were told that I'd need to do another sample. And then on like over the next couple of days, I'd convinced myself that they'd got it wrong. And that this next sample, it was just a blip. They got it wrong and it would all be all right. Anyway, I did the sample again and the same result came back. This time it was worse. We had an over the phone consultation because I couldn't get there. And they told me that I basically produced like 1,500 sperm in my count, and less than 1% of that was deemed viable. So they like thought like if they could find 15. I don't know how they exactly measure it, but yeah. So my count was low, my mobility and my morphology was just like crashed. Like, there was nothing there. So as you can tell, like it was a complete shock, and for a long time, I still denied it. I was like, they've got it wrong. It'll be fine. And then we decided in the summer of 2012 that we were going to move. And we moved from Sussex, where we were living, to Bedfordshire. And what happened when we moved was we got, because we've relocated under the policy in Bedfordshire, we had to live there for a year before we could access fertility treatment on the NHS. Now, the benefit, we moved because of Jen's work. At the time, I'd literally just finished uni. I was a bit of a late bloomer at uni. So we moved there, and there was a benefit of moving. Like in Sussex, we would have only got one round on the NHS. Where in Bedfordshire, we got three. But we didn't move for that reason. We moved for Jen's work. So, you know, there was a silver lining in that way. But yeah, so we had to go on this year's waiting list, despite them receiving my my results. And knowing it's never going to happen, I just don't have the quality to do it, which was really frustrating. And that was a difficult year. We were literally sat on our hands waiting.
Mm. That's what I was going to ask, really. So you've had those tests. You've literally had a professional sit opposite you and say, Kieran, there's not much we can do for you. You've had those cold, hard, light of day results given to you on a piece of paper, presumably, where your count is 1,500. And like you said, your motility and your morphology was like shot to pieces.
Yeah.
So like that, tell me about that year.
It was just, do you know what? It was the start of my real big downfall. Like, I'll get into it in more detail at some point, but it was a slippery slope. I was still kind of in the denial stage. I was still denying it. And I think part of it was because we weren't moving forward in our treatment. So we were just stuck at the door, if that made sense. Like, they hadn't given me any additional facts for me to go, oh, actually, yeah, I need to kind of process this differently. I'd had two Siemens assessments, and they'd both come back really bad, but that was it.
When was this?
Oh, 2012. Until 2013, the summer of, we just sat and did nothing. There's nothing we could do. And, I mean, there are benefits to it. Like, we moved, and we were able to settle where we moved to without the stresses of a fertility cycle, and new jobs came in, and we were living in Luton in the time, and it, you know, that's a stressful place to go in itself sometimes. I think I can say that because I lived there for a while. So, you know, we had a lot to kind of deal with on other levels, but it was still hard. It was really hard because, especially for Jen, I think, because Jen really wanted to move forward with it. Where I think I was in the mindset of it was difficult, and I knew it was going to be difficult. So I was quite happy just to stand still for a while. You know, if I really kind of break it down, something I've definitely learned is that men and women process things differently. But now what I do know is that if we'd moved forward quicker, I think I would have processed it quicker and at the end had a better mental health result out of it. Because I found it extremely challenging. That kind of empty time.
Yeah. So you had a lot of kind of time to think about it and in some cases bury your head in the sand as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I just buried my head. I buried my head and almost pretended it wasn't there, where it was very active in Jen's mind. Like, she was counting down the days till we can start, till the day she can pick up that phone and go, right, get us in. Where I kind of just switched off from it all, mainly because of how I was feeling. I don't know. Yeah, really tricky. So in 2000, this is where I'm going to have to refer to all my notes because this is where it all gets a bit mayhem. So in the summer of 2013 was when we had our first cycle. And that was a real crazy experience. And it was in Bourne Hall as well. So like Sebi is a baby of Bourne Hall, just like your little ones, mate. And like, before I go into all of that, like, I just want to like praise the work that they do because it's a phenomenal place. And once we kind of got down the journey and, you know, later on in their journey, they really helped me, but I'll get to that shortly.
Should I tell you how I chose Bourne Hall?
Go for it.
So I'd opened up to work about going through fertility treatment. And then one of my colleagues said, well, Martin went and his wife went through that. Like, seriously, what do you lads talk about? And I was like, well, not that. And so I started chatting to him about it. And I said, oh, where did you go? Because we were still like in the phase of looking for our clinics. And he said, oh, we went to this place in Cambridgeshire called Bourne Hall. He goes, basically, the gaff looks like Bruce Wayne's manor. It's really cool. So I was sold.
It does as well, doesn't it? It's really nice.
Yeah. Jenna did a bit more research than me. That was mine. I was done. I was in, all in.
We moved from Sussex to Bedfordshire and they actually placed us in Bourne Hall, which was amazing. Like,
cool.
Couldn't ask for any better treatment. Anyway, so we had our first cycle and everything went really smoothly, like as smooth as it could go. We had ICSI and we got a number of embryos we had one put back in and it took. So we were at a 5-week scan we were deemed pregnant because we had a 5-week scan. There was a heartbeat. I think it was a heartbeat then. But we were deemed pregnant at 5 weeks. I don't know quite how we did it, but we went in for a scan. And so we were really happy and we told everyone. And this is one of the biggest things that I wish we hadn't done. We told everyone because we were so excited because we'd waited this year, right? And then we went back at 7 weeks for another scan and there was no heartbeat. We'd lost the baby, so we had a miscarriage. And so we had to tell everyone that we'd lost the baby, you know, this early on, which was absolutely heartbreaking for both of us, you know. I mean, Jen really did fall apart because we'd waited for so long and this is what we wanted and this is what we've been working towards. And it's something that we definitely learned from. So our next cycles, we didn't tell anyone. We opted to keep it to ourselves. And I think having to explain to everyone what had happened made it even harder. So it's definitely a regret of mine, like going that public that early. But yeah,
it's the same.
Did you?
It's really hard because when you have a fertility treatment, like often people do know, like people knew that we were, but not why. So Jenna shouldered that for years for me. She undertook it as couple infertility. And don't get me wrong, like, you know, we were very much always in it together, but the reason for the why we needed it was never disclosed. But then because people, you know, they love and care for you, they're asking where, like, what's going on, what you're doing. And with some people, and sometimes in general, we just said, like, don't talk to us anymore about it. We needed space. But
yeah,
when it actually came, because we'd had so many knockbacks getting to the first transfer, when we had it, we told people and we were like, right, okay, yeah, so, you know, pregnant until proven otherwise. And then we had that, you do the pregnancy test after the 2 weeks, you'd like the clinic tell you when to do it, and ours was positive, and we told everyone. And the thing is, like, you know, when you don't, I don't know, some people might, but typically I think most people wait until the 12-week scan. And
yeah,
we didn't tell everyone, but a lot of people. And it's weird because that's so early. And then we got to that 7-week scan, like you said, I think they call it the viability scan. And
yeah,
you know, fortunately in our case, there were two little heartbeats. But I think now in hindsight, and the thing is, it's easy to say in hindsight, but it's such an emotionally driven time. But I realized the fragility of what we had done, and by telling people so early, and how delicate things can be that early. But
yeah.
It's, obviously, in our case, you know, we were very blessed and fortunate that they did go all the way, and they're our babies. But
it's just, you're just pleased it's happened. Like, I couldn't see it at the time because, you know, we were both like absolutely heartbroken. But the positive thing was, we got to a certain point, like, and it took. And but we couldn't see that at that time. I still remember the phone call to Jen's mum and dad.
Like, yeah,
FaceTimed them, and we had to tell them, and then we had to hang up. And Jen just sat there and cried, and I'm sat there thinking, we're doing this because of me. You know, that real guilt. That's when I think things change from denial to guilt.
Yeah.
I started to feel worse about the situation, about myself. And I really started to struggle. So that was the summer of 2013. And then we went again in December. You know, everything was good. So we could have a quick turnaround to try again, which was going to be a frozen. And the way it worked was at test day, our 2-week test day was Boxing Day, and we were due to go to my mum's Boxing Day. So we were living in Bedfordshire. My mum was living down in Devon, and the whole family was going down. And basically, just before we left, well, Jen got up, I say just before we left, Jen got up at the crack of dawn to do this test. She was up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I was up with her, and I still remember sitting on the edge of the bath waiting while she did it, because it's that intimate, isn't it, mate? You just kind of, you're there, you're waiting. And there was nothing.
Wow.
This one, there was nothing taken. And, you know, this tear started again, that same feeling from me started again. But we hadn't told anyone. It's Christmas Eve, Boxing Day, sorry. Because it was just after Christmas. And we had to go and put on a happy face for the whole family.
Mm.
And it was incredibly difficult, mate. It was incredibly difficult. And I don't really have many words to describe it, apart from it was probably the toughest 3 days of my life. Mm. Like, trying to manage Jen, trying to explain to everyone that Jen's all right. She's just not feeling too well. She just kept going upstairs and having time to herself. And I'd go upstairs and she'd be upset, crying. And then I'd go back downstairs. And in my head, I'm thinking, this is happening because of me. So you can imagine the cycle that just kept repeating over those 3 days. It was incredibly difficult. But hey, look, we slowly processed it. I think the time of year made it more difficult, because if we'd just been able to hide away in our flat on our own, we could have just coped with it. But everyone's got an expectation of Kieran at Christmas, where I'm the one messing around and having jokes, and I just wasn't there. Everyone knew something was wrong, but no one knew what was wrong. I think parents, like my mum and some of my family, probably guessed, just because they knew things were going on, but they probably just put it down to general stress about the whole situation, not the fact that we'd basically just failed an IVF, an ICSI treatment.
Yeah, so tough.
It was really tough. It was really, really tough. And this is like one of those things that, why I've got these notes here. I forgot about that Boxing Day. And I think I forgot about it because I just blanked it out, because it was horrendous. When I say I forgot, I didn't forget completely. I know it's there, but Jen triggered the memory. I was like, oh shit, yeah, I remember that.
That really does show how traumatic this is.
The fact
that it did take that kind of working out together of what happened, when it was, and the fact that it happened is testament to both the fact that...
Well, I'll tell you something, mate. It was the longest five-hour drive to Devon ever, knowing that what we were going to. But look, we got through it, and it's a story now. You know, it's something that we tell, and I tell it because I want people to know that other people have been through this, how you're feeling. Other people I've talked to have been to family events straight after things like this, and there's little ones running around, and you're thinking, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here at all. And that's completely fine to feel like that, I think.
Yeah.
I think if it hadn't been so organized and everyone expecting us, I would have pulled the plug on it, been like, we're coming. But I couldn't. It was family. It was Christmas.
It's Christmas, isn't it? It's like
where Santa brings you every gift you ever want. Like, didn't bring it.
No. I remember Christmases like that. Not quite as as traumatic as that. But actually, had we had our fresh transfer that we initially had planned, which we couldn't, as I explained, because of the ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, but our pregnancy test would have been on Boxing Day actually that year as well. It's so far to crash off the other side of that, isn't it?
Yeah, incredibly difficult. I mean, the lucky thing is, once again, it went smoothly. I mean, it didn't take, but Jen was well after, you know, it's a lot of drugs they pump into her, and she was all right. So we were able to go again in early 2014, which was another difficult one, because everything was going fine. And then the stimulating drug that they were giving Jen, they reduced it, which basically meant that her follicles that were growing stopped growing, and then they started to reduce, which meant that we actually ended up having two... We only got two eggs from the egg collection, and they were really poor quality. And they only got to day two of transfer, and then they're like, we want to put them back because they're not going to last. And that was frustrating itself, because actually it wasn't us that had made any, like, we'd done everything to the book, and it was just it's just a medical thing. They reduced it because they were worried she was going to overstimulate, and it had the opposite effect. It literally, it was like pulling the plug on a TV. It just turned off and started to shrink. So we had them put back, and they just didn't take nothing. It was another tough one, but that was tough because of, we felt like it could have been played out differently. It was the reduction in the drugs that caused the issue, not Jen's body or my body or, you know, the cells themselves. But then once again, I was back at the point of, this is happening because of me, you know, more guilt. And I really, at that point, kind of crashed. And I kind of went into, well, there's no other way of putting it, I had a complete breakdown, I'd stopped socializing with my friends. It happened gradually, but it kind of hit me at that point in 2014. So I stopped socializing with friends. I couldn't do daily function. I couldn't function in my workplace. I couldn't communicate with Jen effectively. I'd started to drink more again, and I was in a real bad place. And we decided that we'd take a break, and basically get our heads in gear, get my head in gear, so we could face what was going to be like a last kind of roll of the dice, in the best possible position we could be in. But it took over a year to get me right. And this is where Bornhall came into its own, where Jen reached out to her and said, look, my husband's in a really bad way. And then they got me in and gave me some counseling. And I don't say it very often, but I was suicidal at that point. I just didn't know what to do.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a hard thing to say out loud, you know, I just say that. But it's the truth, and people need to know that other people feel that way. But it's important that you talk. Those counseling sessions, I'm convinced, saved my life. I absolutely saved my life. And basically was able to pull apart all the emotions linked to wanting to be a father, and deal with that guilt that I felt connected to the all the fertility treatment we're having. And what it came down to basically was, so me and my dad now have a really good relationship, but growing up, it was very, very strained. And I'm not going to go into loads of details, but it was very difficult. And in the counseling, it came out that all I wanted to do really was correct the wrongs that had been done to me. And the only way I unconsciously could do that by being a good dad, you know? So I had a lot to deal with. I ended up, I for the first three counseling sessions, I sat there and just nodded. I was like, yeah. And then Jen was basically like, look, you need to talk. You just need to talk. And on that fourth one, I went in and I just started to talk, and I sat there and I cried. I mean, and when I cried for about 45 minutes. And at one point, I couldn't get a word out for about 15 minutes. And I left that counseling room like someone had lifted the world off my back. It had done so much good. And all I needed was someone to talk to. Someone that was disconnected from the whole thing, in terms of they weren't going to cause judgment on me. Because that's what I was afraid of, being judged for the fact of I couldn't, in my mind, I couldn't give my wife the one thing that she really wanted. The one thing that, as in brackets, a man, I should be able to do. And my perception of what a man is has completely changed over these years since that kind of counseling. So, yeah, it was a really emotional few months for me. But I'd finally managed to feel like I was getting back on my feet. And then I started to look into how I could improve my fertility myself. So I started to obviously look into exercise and lifestyle changes, because I was just told you need to make some changes, but there was no guidance. So I managed to focus on that with real success. And the small changes that I made, the first thing I did was get rid of the alcohol. And it was one of the best things I did for that cycle coming up. It made me able to think clearer. My body responded better. And from the semen analysis that I had, alcohol plays a massive part in my fertility health. When I drink, there's a big plummet in the quality of my semen. I lost some weight just kind of started to feel better about myself and better about the situation. And it all stems from that bit of counseling.
Mm.
So we actually, it was July 2015. So our last cycle was early 2014. And it wasn't until July 2015 that we went again. We had a proper break because I was in such a mess. And what happened was, it was really successful in terms of we had really two really strong embryos. So despite the doctors requesting that we didn't, we wanted both in. We asked for them to put both back because it was our last roll of the dice. At the 7-week scan, there was two heartbeats. We had two heartbeats. And of course, we'd been here before, so we were a bit cautious, but we were pleased. We were happy. And then we went back for a 12-week scan, and there was two embryos, but only one heartbeat. So we had lost one of the twins. We still refer to Sebi as having a twin.
Mm.
And he talks, he asks us questions about it and stuff because he's aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
So we'd lost one of the twins, but Sebi was still like, his heart, little heart was pumping strong. And then we went back at, this is the most bizarre thing about this, as we went back at week 20 and that embryo had disappeared. So it's called vanishing twin syndrome. And basically Jen's body had absorbed it, and or Sebi had absorbed it in some way, which I still now think that's a bit weird. But it's an amazing thing how the body knew there was a long time for obviously Jen's pregnancy to continue, so it dealt with what was going on inside internally. And then Sebi was born in March 2016. He was a month early. It was another very emotional day. Basically, I'd got up for work because I was working as a teacher at the time. And I was sat through on the sofa. We had these big lazy boy sofas. So I sat in there and I heard, "Kieran, Kieran." And I was like, "She doesn't need me. She's fine. I was just eating my cereal." I was like, I'm not going through. And then it got a bit more panic. It was like, "Kieran, Kieran." And I was like, "What do you want?" Because we only lived in a small flat. She was like, "Come here now." So I was like, "All right, I'm coming. So I went through and she got up and the waters had gone and it was everywhere. And I was like, "Oh, shit." I was like, "This isn't supposed to happen. It's not a month. We've got a month. We've got a month yet." And she was like, You're telling me we've got a month. I haven't even got a bag pack." She kept going, "I haven't got my bag pack." So we got her into the bath and her waters broke at 7:10 in the morning.
Mm.
And at the time, Jen was working as a midwife. And she was trying to figure out how she could keep the baby inside her for another month. Because she was like, I'm not ready. But now, like, obviously, she's reflected on that. Like, it was the impossible task, wasn't it? But so we had a crazy 12 hours. And in the end, we had to go into theatre. And Sebi was born using forceps. Because he didn't tuck his chin as he was coming out. He looked up, which meant that he just basically blocked. So he couldn't come out. His head got stuck in that. I think it's got stuck in our pelvis. So they had to go in. I mean, I don't think Jen gets enough credit for this, and like, or any woman that has to go through it. So they had to go in through the, like, the vagina. They didn't bring him out the sunroof. They had to go in and basically manipulate him out with forceps and that, and like really intrusive stuff for Jen. Anyway, he popped out, they pulled him out, and she was so delirious because obviously they just kind of, I think it's an epidural, did they give him into the lower back?
Yeah.
And they laid him on her chest, a bit skin to skin straight away. And she was so out of it. She was like, whose baby is this? I don't understand. Where's my child? Like, and I said to her, this is our son. This is our son. And I can remember saying it like three or four times before she kind of registered it. But she was so like high on everything. She kept asking me, is this ours? Is this our son? Like, it was such a crazy 20 minutes. But because he was born so early here, because he was a month early, he had to go to NICU. He went up to NICU. But there was a moment before he went up where he was okay, but they had to keep an eye on him. And they put him in one of those little plastic trays, you know, that they do. It sounds really bad, but like little incubation unit. But it didn't have a roof on it. I remember walking up there and just holding my hand out, and he grabbed my finger. And it was just like a surreal moment of, I've never met you before, but I'll die before anything happens to you. Do you know what I mean? That real kind of moment of this has happened. And that whole, the previous 5 years or six, however long it was, just went away. All that pain, all that everything was worth it for that moment. Anyway, they took Sebi up to the ward, and I checked Jen was all right, but then I went up to Seb's and stayed with him for a bit, and then they were like, you've got to go. And it was like the hardest thing in the world. Like, I've waited years for this, but I've got to leave. So I went home and I sat down and I put the TV on. It was like, you know, 1:45 in the morning by now. Because it was like a mental, like, 6 hours since Sibby was born. And I just fell asleep. I just remember falling asleep. And I woke up in the morning. I got a beer out of the fridge. And I hadn't even drunk it. I hadn't sipped it, nothing. I just knocked off asleep because I was so exhausted. And then there was like a week of in and out of the hospital, checking they were all right. And then we got him home eventually. So yeah, that was the journey to baby number one. And it was a difficult one at parts, really difficult. But like I said, at that moment that I met him, it kind of all just vanished. All that pain vanished for a period of time. You know, that's important to know, because I was still struggling, like, mentally with a lot of things. But the clouds had definitely started to clear. So yeah, that was to March 2016. I became a dad, and it was a wonderful, wonderful day for me. And Jen, obviously, and Jen.
She was there.
She had a big part to play, mate.
Mate, that's incredible. Like you said, that's just journey to baby one, but there's so much to it, and like I said, like with my episode, there's so much more to undress. Right, this is just kind of like the overarching story, but I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you in more depth about in future episodes, like, you know, your real lows, and, you know, saying that you felt suicidal, and that's quite, you know, a huge thing to say, and especially as we know the stats of men, is what, the biggest killer of men under 50 or something like that?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a real thing. Like, it's taken me ages to be able to say it out loud. And I've done interviews about my fertility and I've gone, I really wasn't happy, or I've kind of clouded over it. But I think this is the first time I've outly said, like, I was suicidal. Like, I just didn't know. I didn't see a way out of it.
The fact that, you know, you recounted a lot of your pain and admitting that as a man you had fertility issues, and then there's still things that you struggle to admit. And I had the same thing, but on a very similar theme, actually, in that I was probably 2 years into sharing my story again about being a male who is infertile. Well, you know, you had fertility issues. I'm saying that I got zero sperm, not saying that it's any worse or next, but that, like, the stigma behind it is obviously massive. And I've been sharing that for about 2 years, and it was only this summer that I openly admitted for the first time that I was struggling with depression whilst going through it. And because it's part of the of grief, it's one of the stages. And I was going, I went through the four stages, depression, well, more like, kind of, I was down for a bit. I just couldn't say it. I could not say it. And it's funny how there's these other stigmas. You admit in one, and these other ones that are still seemingly so hard to come out with.
You still hold on to another, like, as if that is a shameful thing, and it's not. I've kind of been working on this for a while in terms of in my head, in terms of getting to the point of being able to say, that's how I felt. That's how I felt. But it was bizarre because people... Like I said, that all my pains went away. Like, the pain of the journey went away when I first met Seb. But I still had a lot to process. At the moment, I'll go on to, like, you know, the journey for baby number two. But in between that time, I was having panic attacks like no one could believe. I'd never had them before. I remember having the first one.
And wow.
I genuinely thought I was dying. I thought, what the fuck is going on here? Like, everything, it was like all my senses were turned up to like 1,000. My heart was racing. I was like, I can't see her. I can't. I was driving, just driving along, and I was driving to work, I was driving to Sebi. I was taking Sebi to nursery. So this was quite a bit of time after it had passed, and it was like, bang. I remember having this panic attack, and all I wanted to do was get out the car, just stop the car and get out. But I couldn't because Seb was there. And he's in the back chatting away, like, you know, being like a two-year-old is. And I'm like, inside, all my alarm bells are ringing. I don't know where it's come from. And it kept happening. It happened for about a year, just kept happening. And then that's where, like, when COVID kicked in, like, a lot of people, you mentioned last week about how COVID was really good for you and Jenna's relationship and being together at that time that you hadn't had, and you were able to have that close time together. COVID couldn't have come at the best time, better time for me. It allowed me to press reset, like, and drastically press it, because I'd stop going out again. Like, I wouldn't even go to, the supermarket. I'd go to work, I'd come back, that was it. It happened again.
Have you ever, like, undressed where that anxiety was coming from then, those panic attacks?
No, I just put it down to, like, additional layer of processing of what was going on. It was almost like my body, like, releasing all this mental stress I've been holding on to. I don't know how else to explain it. The last one I had... the school that I work in is a Quaker school. We have something called an open day. And at the end of the year, each year, everyone goes into the meeting house and the head talks to the whole school. And it's quite enclosed. And I was sat on one of the rafters right at the top. And I was absolutely fine. I had Seb sat next to me and I had Jen the other side. And then bang, it just kicked in. And there must have been like, I don't know, 500 people in this thing. And I'm like, fuck. I need to get out of here. And my head is running wild from being nothing to everything at once. And I managed just to sit there. I don't know how I saw it through. I just sat there. And I left that meeting house and I went for a walk and it never happened again. I've never even like experienced anything like it again. So they seem to have come and gone. But I'm convinced it was just my body releasing that last bit of stress that I was feeling. And then, so I'll get on to like our next little mini journey to have a second bubby. So it might have been that in my head I knew that I hadn't finished having children, like I wanted another child. And while I was having all these panic attacks and other things, I kept having this reoccurring dream. And it's generally this is how it used to happen. I used to dream that I was walking along the beach and I'm walking into the sun with my eyes shut and I can hear the waves. And then someone takes my hand and I look down and there's a little girl walking along with me. And it sounds really cheesy in that, but I used to have this reoccurring dream. And I used to then wake up and be like, what was that about? Does that mean that? And I went through a really deep processing of it. Like I thought, because I wouldn't say I'm spiritual, but I didn't know whether or not you don't know what really happens in this world. We don't. We kind of guess, but you don't. And I had a weird kind of thought of, was that because she was around about Sebi's age? And I thought, was that the twin that we lost? You know, that's generally like, what am I still processing this? Or is it me kind of telling myself that I would like a daughter, you know? So, fast forward to, I think it was summer 2019, we decided to go again. And in the back of my head, I had this dream in my head. It sounds crazy, but it's just how it played out. And that's when we first went to Leeds, and we didn't feel comfortable there. We didn't think it was the right setting for us. I think after you've been to Bourne, it's really, you know, your standards are high. I must have like kind of highlighted that we'd already moved. We moved to the north in between this time. Standards are really high. And we were just like, you know what, Leeds isn't going to cut it for us. So we ended up going to care in Sheffield because they actually had like the best statistics and best reviews basically about just client care. I know it's in the name, isn't it? Felt really at home there. As soon as we got there, we were spoken to as a couple, people that had experienced it. Like we weren't novices. Our opinion was really taken in consideration. And it just felt a lot more, comfortable than when we were in Leeds. You know, some people might go to Leeds and think that's fine and they're happy with that, but we were just looking for something slightly different. So in the summer of 2019, we went for a fresh cycle. And basically, Jen overstimulated. And we were away in Pickering, which is near Scarborough. We're in a caravan. And she said she didn't feel very well. And then the shit show hit like nothing else. Like she was so ill, mate. Like she thought she was going to die that night. Because she was so unwell, she just bloated and like she majorly overstimulated. So we ended up, coming back, getting her into hospital. And they gave us the same kind of spiel as what you explained last week or a couple of weeks ago, sorry, mate. And it's really hard to see your wife in that situation. Really, really hard, especially when you're rolling the dice because you want to, not because you necessarily need to. And I know there are going to be people here that, you know, listening that find that difficult to hear, but we were trying for another one. So we had the big conversation of, do we just stay at one because Jen became so unwell? But after some time and some reflection, we decided, no, we do want to try it again. And Care were amazing. They like brought us in. We had another chat. They approached things completely different. So I think for the one that was overstimulated, we had a long protocol. So in terms of stimulation of drugs. Now for Sebi, we actually had a short one. So they were like, well, shall we try a short protocol and see how it goes? And I got, this is where I have to refer to my notes, you know, because it just blurs here. It just didn't work. So we'd had a fresh overstimulation. From that, they had some that had been frozen. So then we put those back in and they didn't take. But from that, they still had some left, some frozen left. Which then in January 2020, they put back in, and Enya came from one of the two they put back in. I have to get my head around this, mate. So So basically, we had a frozen. No, we had a fresh to begin with. Jen overstimulated. They froze everything from that. And then we had two put back in initially from a frozen. A cycle, nothing took, and then we had another two put back in, and Enya came from one of them because we got so many eggs from the first lot. That's I'm pretty sure that's it was a lot shorter, but it was very intense, you know. It was quick, and Jen being unwell really kind of put us on high alert. But yeah, and then the day Enya came was a bit crazy in itself. So 3 weeks before Enya actually arrived, Jen started contracting, and we thought she was coming. So we'd got Jen was convinced she was going to have a pool at home, like a birth pool at home. So I'd filled it up. The midwives had come, and after 5 hours or 3 hours, 4 hours, something like that, it ended up that it was just really strong Braxton Hicks. So it's just contractions that were getting her body ready. And then 3 weeks after that, we had a sudden dash. Jen was like, baby's coming. And it must have been, this started at 11 o'clock at night. And I said, right, let's just see what happens, because we've been here before. By 1 o'clock, she was in the car and we were hammering down to Wakefield, a local hospital. And we got there and within an hour, I think it's like an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, Enya arrived. So she came quick. So yeah, that's the journey to baby number two. It's a bit shorter than the other one, just because my head was in a lot better place. Yes, I had those panic attacks, but they had stopped. And it was a bizarre thing when I first met Enya, because I felt like I'd finally met the little girl in my dreams. And I always say that, like, Jen found me, Sebi saved me, and then Enya completed me. You know, it's... I really think about it, and that's how my journey kind of ended. I still felt like there was a bit to deal with emotionally. So I kind of reached out And I found the HIM fertility group, and I became a member of that. And that helped. I think during that, going to those meetings, I kind of transitioned from someone who was there looking for support to someone who could support. And that really kind of came to a head when I went to Everest base camp with the HIM fertility group. When I got to base camp, Ian was walking around, Ian Stones was walking around with a camera, and he was trying to get pictures of us all while we were there. And he was like, "You're going to say something for the camera?" And I was so emotional. I was like, "I can't, mate. Just leave me alone. Just leave me alone." I was really blunt. I was like, "Just leave me alone, man." And I went and sat on a rock and looked up at Everest. And I had a few tears to myself. I was like, everything I've been through over the last 10 years has brought me to this moment.
Mm.
And then I got up from that rock and I went back to the group. And it was another one of those transitions and phases in life where the guy that went over to that rock was a different guy. It was a different guy to the one that came back. You know, my brain had clicked. I feel free of all the anxieties and all the discomforts linked to that now. And it happened at that moment, well, from my fertility journey. So it kind of had a nice ending for me. Like it had a specific point I remember. So yeah, it was a one hell of a 10-year journey.
Mate, that's quite a story. It's incredible. And like I said, there's so much I can't wait to unpack and undress more. I mean, and like, you know, mentioned about your strength in admitting what you went through and how you felt. Mm. Also stuff like that you just kind of drop in there that, oh, Jen was a midwife throughout yeah. that. Like, and how incredibly tough that must have been for her. And then coming home, and then it just increases that guilt that you must have been feeling. And there's, wow, you know, so much to talk about. Like, so many similarities I resonate with as well throughout what you were saying.
You know, like, as I said to you, like, off air, it wasn't until I wrote all this down that I was like, man, that's a busy 10 years. You know, no wonder I was feeling it, you know. You know, ultimately, I got what I wanted from it in terms of my children. But I genuinely think I'm a better human being for going through it. Like I am a better father for it. I'm a better husband. I'm just a better friend, a better son, better brother. You know, all those things that even though other people might not see it all the time, decisions that I make and things that I do now are very carefully thought out and not spontaneous. Like I'm not like that anymore. So yeah, although it was a stressful one, I wouldn't change a thing. I really wouldn't change a thing. Because ultimately it's made me into the person I am. And you've just got to look at it like that. Got to look at it like that.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I say. Absolutely what I say, and it's true, and you know, look at the strength that you've shown and are showing every day to keep showing up and being who you are because of what you went through. And you know, you hit the real lows, like you talk about. A couple of key points that came up for me, one being that Christmas, like wow, like that, and then to come from that point to where you are now is quite incredible, mate.
Cheers, man. It's really strange when I look at it on reflection. Like it's a lot to go through, and just take every day as it comes now. Like I live in the moment, don't worry about the future. The future will look after itself. That's something that I learned, but it's very hard to do that when you're in such a stressful situation.
So one thing I was wondering actually from when you were chatting away was, so when you made those lifestyle changes, and cut out booze and as we know, like kind of then went into more fertility friendly fitness yeah. regimes, but what happened to your sperm health after that?
So my sperm health went from 1500 viable sperm with a 1% 1500 sperm with 1% viable or less than 1%. It went to 4 million with over 4% viable, which is a drastic increase. Like, it really improved.
Is it? Yeah.
And even though I still needed ICSI treatment, you know, we openly had the conversations with the consultant of whatever I was doing drastically improved the quality of my sperm. And even though there wasn't the 20 million that everyone's supposed to have, the ones that were there and the ones that were viable were much, much better quality. And they grade them. Do they grade them double A? Is it double A's? I've forgotten what the top grade is.
I'm not sure. Basically, I wouldn't know, mate.
Oh, sorry, mate.
That's fine.
But they, they basically said like they couldn't be any better. And it was because of what we put into place. But that in itself is a journey. And I'll talk about that another time. But
That's not an overnight fix. There's a lot to talk about. And that's an important, really important message to get across to people who have got that chance of turning things around. Because as you know, from what you do now, lifestyle plays a massive role in infertility. And modern lifestyles are not conducive with good fertility, especially not for men. Yeah. And there was a program on Channel 4 recently, actually, wasn't there, about it, that our current lifestyles with how much we sit down, which is then overheating our balls because they're then stuck between our thighs more, the things we're eating, the lack of exercise, the microplastics in our diet, all of the hormonal disruptors out there. And these are all things that can be changed with more of a conscious effort. And like you said, you know, booze, huge. Right,
it's a massive thing. Like if someone was listening to this and they were thinking, what can I do to like immediately improve my fertility or at least give it the best possible go, I'd say cut your booze out. And if you're a smoker, stop smoking.
Yeah.
You're basically poisoning the body. The rest of it can be all built around, but you can make the decision to stop boozing now, you know?
Yeah, I did. Even though I knew there was very little chance of it, of finding any sperm, you have to do everything that you can to give yourself, like, I didn't want any regrets. So I kicked it for 19 weeks, and including through Christmas. Yeah. And like, you know, went to Christmas parties and drinking non-alcoholic beers and it's just, I had a colleague refuse to buy me one.
Sad, isn't it?
It's like, if you're not having a proper beer, I won't buy you one. Thought he was joking.
Didn't.
But again, that's something that society, that's a lot, and that's often what men go through fertility battles face. Yeah. And that's, again, something which we have so much to talk about.
There's just so much, mate. There's so many layers of this. But yeah, that's my story. I hope it came across all right. I have a habit of just gabbling, so I'm sure it did. I'm just hope that someone can take something from it, and get something out of it they need.
I can guarantee it will, because it did blow my mind, and it makes me feel really privileged and honoured to share this space with you and to know you, quite frankly.
Cheers, mate. I really appreciate that. And to you, like, your story a couple of weeks ago was fantastic. And I think the more we talk, hopefully the more stories people will come and tell us, because that's what we're here to hear. It's been a great evening. Yeah. Mate. I've really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Me too. And you, that's quite a smooth transition. We're getting better.
We're getting slightly better, aren't we?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.